Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. This show is brought to you by Swarbricks, the first law firm in New Zealand to accept Bitcoin for legal services. The team at Swarbricks are Bitcoiners, and they are knowledgeable about the legal aspects of Bitcoin in New Zealand in areas like estate planning, property, and trusts, as well as general legal help. Swarbricks offers a 20% discount for services paid in Bitcoin. Find out more at swarbricks.co.nz/bitcoin. Now, in today's episode, I talk with Jason Mayer. Jason is the author of A Progressive's Case for Bitcoin, A Path Towards a More Just, Equitable, and Peaceful World. The book introduces Bitcoin to a progressive audience focused mainly on the United States, and Jason talks about how Bitcoin can actually help bring about positive social change. He also dispels some of the common misconceptions about Bitcoin that would otherwise slow adoption amongst those who need it most. I talk to Jason about what progressive means for him, the relevancy of political labels and tribalism in a digital world, and how Bitcoin can be understood from a New Zealand perspective. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you. Otherwise, on to the show. Thank you for making the time. I much appreciate it.
Yeah.
So welcome. You're the author of A Progressive's Case for Bitcoin, A Path Towards a More Just, Equitable, and Peaceful World. I've got my copy just here. I read it on the weekend.
Perfect.
I must say I was quite impressed. Well done.
Thank you very much.
No, you're welcome. I really felt like it was a good primer for someone who may have only ever encountered Bitcoin as a headline. But it also, I think it did provide a lot of value for people who are also familiar with Bitcoin, like myself. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a great concise history of modern money, a little bit about how Bitcoin works, a breakdown of some of the common misconceptions. But in particular, it felt like a very human-centric book, highlighting how Bitcoin can help people. Clearly, the intention of the book was to speak to a progressive audience in the United States, Jason, but I'm really keen to start off this conversation by sort of understanding what progressive means for you.
Mm-hmm. So, when I wrote the book, and thank you for having me on, I'm excited to have this chat. It wasn't coming from a place of, like I was really upset in a political sense about like the space of the state of the Bitcoin space. It wasn't as if the book was some sort of like political protest against what is. It was more along the lines of, I know that if we want to reach people, we need to be able to speak their language and sort of convince them that Bitcoin is a good thing. And meet them where they are. And a lot of the resources out there just probably would turn a lot of people off if they dug deep and they said, hey, learn about Bitcoin. And they just clicked on the first couple of things that showed up on the internet. Then they're going to find a lot of things that they just didn't jive with politically and that would turn them off. So, you think about what the target audience is for the book and what progressive means is there's a very large number of, people who don't know anything about Bitcoin except for the headlines or maybe what they've heard from a politician or two. They naturally just assume that it's a scam and it doesn't, it's not worth anything. And they're also left of center, right? They vote for, in the US, they vote for Democrats. They consider themselves progressive and liberal. They think that there's a role for the government in society that can do good and that they want to push the government towards doing good. That's more or less like the target audience, right? A person who is, voting for Joe Biden because they just can't stomach voting for the other person. They're not maybe excited about Joe Biden, but there isn't an option to vote for, the opponent. So I think that's the target audience. It's obviously there's a lot of overlap with progressive ideals and what Bitcoin can do. There's also a lot of overlap between libertarianism and liberal politicians and liberal policies. So I'm just trying to find those overlaps and that connection and really just frame Bitcoin in a way that speaks to people so that hopefully they can get a conviction and continue their education. What you said earlier is that it's a good primer and that's how the book was written. It's meant to be a 0-1 introduction. Something that will get you excited about learning more about Bitcoin and do it in a way that speaks to you as an individual, not you, but a progressive person. Hopefully, we can just broaden out, and the next wave of adoption will come from a different group of people, and we can work towards this global money thing that we're all trying to get to.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think what was really interesting for me, again, the context here is really important. You know, I'm from New Zealand, you know, small island nation, South Pacific. A lot of people confuse it with Australia. People don't even know where it is in many cases. and I look at from afar, you know, from outside, I look at the United States political system, and I see this, it's a black and white, left and right. Everything is one or the other. And it's very curious for me. I mean, I'm not sure how much you know about New Zealand, but I would categorize it historically, and perhaps still today, it's a very progressive country. I mean, there's obviously nuances and challenges with that once you're here on the ground. But certainly, in terms of government, you know, there's a mixed member of parliament system. So your vote isn't wasted. If you vote for a small party, that can still be part of a government. There's a lot of these innovations in the way parliament works. And of course, there's challenges as well in terms of other aspects constitutionally. But I look at the US, you've got this one side or the other system, very partisan. And it is curious for me, because I read your book, and it's very practical and common sense. You know, there's nothing that stands out to me as being particularly contentious on either side, because quite equally, I can read The Road to Serfdom, Austrian Economics, Libertarian Material, and I can, you know, both of those make sense to me as well. Like, there's, it's sort of like, how did we get here? Is this a reflection on the state of the US political system? Like, it's very arbitrary, very emotional. Like, where did this divide even come from?
It's a great question. And of course, you know, there's a good chance that I'm just too close to it to give you the perfect prescription diagnosis for it. But it's true. I mean, I think that in America, things have become overly politicized, overly polarized. And the feeling is that if I tell you how I feel about one issue, hot button issue or whatever, then you'll know how I feel about, you know, 12 other things, because we've ended into this state of like tribalism where like any sort of deviation from that party line is going to result in like really awkward conversations or not being invited back to parties or whatever the case is, right? Whatever group you happen to be in. And that's true for the left and the right. I think it's a combination, like what caused this? I think it's a combination of a two-party system, which I don't think is healthy. It's a combination of, you know, just the news becoming a 24-hour news cycle and people having to fill space with things that, you know, are going to get eyeballs on it. And realizing that you can really make probably a lot more money if you just hone your pitch in your 24-hour news to one side versus the other. So I just think that there's a couple of different factors that go into it, but it certainly is true. And for those, you know, people listening who aren't on the ground in America, like it's an upsetting thing. And usually you're in your own political bubble and your own echo chamber. So you just don't really see it or you don't think about it, but you certainly know that you don't like the other side. And that, like I said, it cuts both ways. So being in Bitcoin allowed me to expose myself really for the first time in my adult life to a lot of ideas that I didn't necessarily agree with or that I never would have been exposed to if I hadn't gotten into Bitcoin. And I'm grateful for that. I think I didn't necessarily burst the political bubble that I was in, but I became part of two different ones. And it's really interesting to see the overlap of sort of the complaints and the problems that people see in the world, and even some of the solutions that people are proposing are really more aligned than you might think if you just listen to the media. And they're just playing left versus right, red versus blue. And so it's been kind of a nice privileged position for me to be in to say, okay, I'm sort of part of this liberal, progressive, democratic bubble. And I'm also now well established in this Bitcoin circle. And, you know, for me to be able to see the overlap and the connections there that maybe other people in those bubbles can't see has been kind of, like I said, it's a privilege to be able to see that and then maybe bridge the gap through Bitcoin if you know, all goes to plan.
Yeah. Well, being able to have open channels of communication is a really great starting point. If you've got people just shouting over each other, that's not productive. I am curious, Jason, would you characterize growing up, you know, your background, your family progressive? Like what part of the US did you grow up in? What was that like?
Yeah.
Did that influence you?
I grew up in upstate New York. Well, and try to describe it. It was a pretty rural place, more or less, right? It's away from New York City, but it's part of New York State. I grew up in the city originally, and then moved out to the suburbs. And growing up, my parents were not progressive or liberal at all. They voted for Republicans. They considered themselves very conservative. And that was how I was brought up. And I was taught, right versus wrong through that lens. And I continued to sort of grow and expose myself to new ideas, new people, new learning. And my entire adult life since high school, I've sort of categorized myself as a progressive. I'm not a member of the Democratic Party. Like I'm not registered as a Democrat. You don't have to be. I just vote for the people who align most closely with my ideals. And that's people who are part of, like we say, we have a two-party system. Those are Democrats, but then you can vote for like Green Party or Working Families Party. It just happens to be those people who are running on those parties are also the Democratic, candidate too, right? So, that's more or less my background is like, in a political sense, I'm just a pleb, right? Like I go to political rallies, I'll vote for people, I will do phone banking for presidential candidates I like. But I'm not any sort of like, I don't have a, some sort of position in a political, I'm not a political operative. I'm not a lobbyist or anything like that. Right? I'm just sort of a regular dude when it comes to, politics and, and it's completely different. My parents, aren't necessarily thrilled that I wrote a progressive case for Bitcoin because they really have to just like acknowledge the fact that I'm not, I don't align with them politically, but it's fine. We still have Thanksgiving dinner and everything's good. So,
yeah, that's interesting though. You mentioned tribalism, this kind of almost reactionary approach to the two sides. And again, it's very curious for me because, New Zealand has this mixed member of parliament system. The joke is it's the purple party, and I think it's maybe similar in the US, but then you've got smaller parties, you've got local representation really close that you can go and talk to. And you might find in a case that it's a vote for a smaller party for your party vote, and then one of the larger parties for your local MP, local representative. And so there is this system, which is quite an innovation that's only really happened in the last couple of decades, but it seems like this tribalism is very destructive, certainly from the outside. And you've got media built around these two sides. And almost as you say, a talking point, one question can tell you someone's entire political leanings in the current system. And I'm just wondering, I'm not sure if you're familiar with The Sovereign Individual, which is a book that came out in 1997, which really looks at some of what the authors call the mega political forces. And I'm just wondering whether the idea of political labels are really becoming irrelevant moving forward. When you can't even have a conversation about politics without it becoming just a binary thing, how does that work? How does that fix itself? I mean, is that still going to be relevant in a Bitcoin world?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think that the aspiration, at least from my perspective, is that Bitcoin helps us transcend some of those political categories, those labels. I do think that's a worthy goal to have. I think that the path that we're heading down, at least it seems like the United States is maybe leading on this curve in a bad way of sort of polarization and tribalization. And, we can only hope that the rest of the world doesn't follow as drastically as we have. But it's not a good path to be on, right? So I do think that there's a hope and an aspiration that Bitcoin might be the thing that becomes transcendent of these political labels. The reality on the ground is that I can't go up to somebody who voted for Joe Biden, a couple of years ago, and say, let's transcend your political label and learn about Bitcoin. Like it has to go in the other direction. I have to meet them where they are and say, what are the problems that you see in the world? And what are some potential solutions that you've never really thought of because you haven't been exposed to these ideas? And let's talk about what's the vision for the world that you have, and how do you think these problems should be solved, and what are the problems? And in most cases, like any problem that comes up, for the most part, is going to have some tie into Bitcoin, because money is the sort of like base layer of all social interaction. So you can find an argument for that person to say, hey, Bitcoin does this differently. Or, I know you haven't thought about it through this lens, but that problem isn't only caused by what your politicians are telling you. It's caused by there's these other things too. So the goal is to transcend those political categories, but people aren't comfortable, at least in the United States and the people I've talked to, getting rid of their labels, because that's sort of that's where they feel comfortable, right? That they know that's their framing around the world. And that's how they can sort of orientate all of their political thinking. Getting rid of that or transcending that as a step one is really difficult. And so I think that Bitcoin does allow us to have different conversations. It does allow two different people on different ends of the political spectrum to look at a problem and say, how can we come up with a solution that makes sense? But we need to get people on board first, right? We need to get people like into the lifeboat so that they can understand what's going on. And then at some point in the future, maybe they transcend their political identities or their labels, and they actually find common ground and have really respectful and productive debates about the things that they don't agree on. We're so far away from that at least, in my experience and where I live, that it doesn't seem like it can't be a first step. It has to be like step two or three.
Yeah, or I certainly feel it's been perhaps the last 5 years that American style divisionism, I don't know what it would be, but in New Zealand is certainly a small island, it's historically been, there's just kind of been consensus seeking behavior, but most recently, that really feels like that there's been this desire to almost create the theatrics of division when there is none on the ground, and certainly in this country, it's a different system. Ultimately we have more in common with our neighbors than we do with the power structure. And it's like, you talk about your parents, mm-hmm. perhaps being, Republican supporters. I mean, it's your family, like it can't be that different. I can't be that different from, what I mean?
Right. There's a bumper sticker, right? Some of my favorite people are Republicans, because I'm related to them.
And I wonder, again, coming back, to the sovereign individual, which, is, I think, quite prescient in some of its predictions around how this move from the industrial state to a kind of an information society will reflect, mm-hmm. be reflected in changes in power structures. And, you saw this historically with the move away from feudalism and the church and its role in everyone's lives. Are we seeing something like that, where perhaps we're the last throes of government, where everything is about politics, everything's politicized, everything's professional politicians, mm-hmm. is that going to go away as they get demonetized, as they're not able to control the power structure of money, of war, of all these things you talk about in the book? And it just becomes more of a function, maybe a little bit more like your local city government, local city council, where maybe they can do some ordinances and stuff, but they can't really drastically go and invade a country or massively change the way you live your life.
And I mean, I've read, there's a lot to learn from Sovereign Individual. I mean, I've read the book, and I don't agree with everything. But I do think that I've always left room in my thinking, to say, well, I'm not progressive in the sense that like I support the US Democratic Party, right? No matter what. I'm progressive in the sense that like I have certain values and ideals that I care about.
Progress.
And I think that I've always left room in my thinking to say that like the nation state as it exists today is not necessarily always going to be, and that's okay in my mind, that still jives well with my values and my principles. The nation state is powerful, large federal government that can invade other countries and sort of impose its will on other nations. That doesn't necessarily, much to people's surprise, when they like to label me or tell me what it is to be progressive, like that doesn't jive with my political ideologies, having like a very large government that can impose its will on other nations and control people. And so you know, there is room in my thinking for smaller local governments that are more efficient, more responsive to the people and people living in community with one another and finding consensus, as you say. It doesn't have to be on a small island. It can be on a small island called what, you know, your town or your city or your county. And so I don't know if it's, I guess the answer is that is a possibility. And I would welcome something like that if it sort of fit that vision of my progressive values. But I don't think it's a certainty. I think that the government as it exists right now is a very powerful and important institution within our society. And that, it could be that once things, we take the money levers away from the control of government, that they can no longer exist. I would say the most likely outcome in my thinking is that they become smaller and more efficient, more transparent, and more more responsive to the people that they're governing, which is also a win. So, I don't necessarily subscribe to the traditional libertarian view that we don't need the government and whatever we can do to get rid of it or make it smaller is good. I do think that there is a role for the government to ensure that we are protecting people and lifting up the most vulnerable in society, and the government is good at some things and bad at others. And I don't see it going away necessarily anytime soon. And, well past my lifetime, I can see that the total shift might change also, but it's hard to make predictions, right? So either one of those two things could happen, and the timeline is uncertain, but both of those moves would be promising for me. It would be improvements.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, a more efficient, smaller government. I mean, if you just left it at that straight away, that's a very classical kind of libertarian idea, right? But you come to that from a different place. And
yes.
I, again, that's what I'm kind of saying. I read your book, and then I kind of contrast that with my New Zealand lived experience. And it's like, oh, yeah, there's nothing in here that's super controversial or anything. No. and alongside something like the sovereign individuals is extremely one way.
Right.
They're talking to each other as opposed to over each other. And one thing you mentioned, talking about solutions in the Bitcoin space, something really interesting is there's a real focus on building solutions. Cypherpunks write code, and Bitcoiners make stuff happen, right? You've written a book. I don't know if you intended on being an author when you started this journey, but you've gone and done it, and you've done the proof of work. I certainly didn't intend on being a podcast host or facilitating some of the stuff that I do, but I was anointed with that role, and now I take it on. And in a way, there's sort of something really powerful about that, because you're stepping away from the sophistry and the spoken word of politics, where language is cheap, it's proof of stake, right? But actually going and doing something about it and sitting down and making solutions, there's something that Bitcoin that kind of brings it together, brings people to the table, and let's make something happen.
Absolutely. And that's been my experience throughout being in the Bitcoin space, right? Like, you can have really productive and fruitful, respectful conversations with people, even if you don't agree with them. And certainly, I'm in that role a lot. It's essentially like, what have you done? What can you do? What have you done to help advance the cause or educate people or build better software or user interface? And so that focus on solutions is key. And I think that's the stage we're in, right? Like, we need people who are excited and talented and energized by Bitcoin to go out there and make it like the next, bring it to the next level from where it is now. And that's important, because I do think that it's one of the most important things that we have going in the world to help make the world a better place. And it's interesting, I'll just to go back to something you said about when you word it this way, then, there's nothing controversial in New Zealand, or even maybe in America, somebody can read my book and not be offended by it. I mean, that's with intention, right? Like, I'm coming at this as an educator. My whole, career has been teaching, teenagers mathematics. So I'm not trying to alienate anybody. I'm just trying to bring people into the fold. And what I find just interacting with people in the Bitcoin space, especially, is that it doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. If you're left or right, like you fancy yourself the good guy, right? Like you like to be the person who's doing the good thing. And when you just write a book that says, okay, well, here are some good things you can do at Bitcoin, then people, like all people can relate to that because they always, in their mind, they're already the good guy, right? So, you know, it doesn't really matter if you're left or right. You can kind of attach, you know, yourself to one of these ideas or more of them. And, you know, hopefully promote Bitcoin, you know, through my book to a different audience or just generally, you know, meet the people where they are. If my book isn't the right resource for them, then that's fine, right? Other ones could be.
Yeah. It's interesting though. I guess cynically thinking about this though, I mean, you and I are just plebs on the ground, but is it possible that within the power structures that proclaim to be one side or the other, there is actually a deep desire to hold on to that conflict and that divisionism that means no matter how clearly you provide the evidence and the resources to the contrary, people are going to hold on to pig-headed ideas around FUD and things that you've clearly dispelled and many people have dispelled around the environment, around the energy use, all of that, and mm-hmm. use that because even though it would almost make their role redundant if we had a functioning political system that and the money the money was fixed. You know what I mean?
I do, yeah. And that's one of the, you know, I guess, you know, I would say that my skepticism has risen since being in the Bitcoin space. It certainly is the case that people who are in government and control the levers of power, and that extends beyond government. But the people who are in charge of these decisions are not incentivized to solve the problem. And I think that's, to me, that's very clear, right? There's no money and there's no votes in solving problems. It's in claiming that there's problems and then pointing fingers at the other person, right? So there's no incentive for you to actually solve the issue or to actually fix it. And that's why a lot of liberal and progressive policies right now are still, you know, at least in the United States, are working within a system that's broken and just sort of trying to fix the symptoms, right? So you're trying to make things a little bit more fair, a little bit more equitable, give people who were, you know, not given a chance, make sure they have a chance, whatever it is, right? They're just trying to solve the symptoms. And I think that there's a lot of money in that. There's a lot of votes in that, making people feel bad or guilty, or you should vote for me because the other side is doing it wrong. There isn't an incentive to actually fix the problem. And so if Bitcoin becomes a political football because the people on the left can rally against it and get votes and the people on the right can rally for it and get votes, then it becomes like everything else. And the whole point of the book, the goal of the book, and why I wrote it as quickly as I did and tried to get it out there as fast as I could, was because I don't want Bitcoin to fall into that camp. And, you know, we can see it starting to happen, but there's still plenty of Democrats who are in positions of power who are open to Bitcoin and supportive of the new technology. So hopefully we can get to a tipping point where it doesn't become that political issue that is just used to rally one side versus the other and get votes and get money and all of that stuff. It becomes actually, you know, sort of a neutral thing, as money should be. It becomes sort of like the water you swim in, and it's not controversial and it's not crazy. And that will take a long time, but that's the hope, that we get there eventually.
Yeah, interesting. I feel like there's perhaps more dimensions to this as well, because as you illustrate in the book, there are a number of Republican supporters of Bitcoin, and then there was bipartisan support for that bill around Bitcoin. Democrats and Republicans came together to put that bill together. However, I think about this again from a New Zealand perspective, and I really see it, and excuse me for my Marxist terminology, but it feels like it's a class struggle in the sense that there's normal people on the ground who Bitcoin clearly would benefit from. But then I look at the power structures, which no matter what side, generally speaking, there's say in the US, a number of Republicans who support it, but as a whole, it is a threat to their entire existence. And so that's challenging. I mean, New Zealand, I was looking at, say, the Maori people of New Zealand and sort of their relationship with the state, which in a colonial history, there's some real challenges there. What does that relationship mean with our central bank, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand? I've spoken to a couple of people about that, and I cannot see a reality where the Reserve Bank of New Zealand adopts Bitcoin in any capacity, even though it's perhaps one of the most empowering things for Maori people, for Indigenous people around the world to have their own, you know, neutral money. And you see what I mean? So it's like there's this almost this pleb versus elite power structure struggle, and everything else is a distraction.
Well, yeah, and again, I can speak from the American perspective, right? The people on the right will tell you that that's a power struggle between regular people and the government is, you know, the bad guy. And people on the left, who are Democrats, will tell you that it's a struggle between the, you know, regular people and like corporations and the wealthy business people who own the corporations, right? And so in both cases, you have this like dichotomy where it's like the people in power and in charge of things are not acting with the best of intentions for regular people, right? Like, and that's true, you know, both things can be true at once, right? Like, you know, not everybody in the government is acting with the best of intentions for regular people. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of reasons why people, you know, wealthy, powerful, connected, well-resourced corporations aren't doing that either. So I don't think it's just, ultimately, it's just not one dimensional, like you would believe if you only listen to one side or the other. Yeah. But certainly, it's an interesting dynamic because, as you point out, and it's worth repeating, the Republicans who are supporting Bitcoin right now as politicians, maybe they're doing it just to drum up support. They know if they say this thing, they'll get applause, they'll get people to vote, they'll get people to donate money. But ultimately, it seems like it might be an existential threat to their way of life, right? Their career, their choice of job. And, you know, it's interesting to see how that's going to play out. I have no idea how it's going to play out and whether or not politicians all get on board because that's the beneficial thing to do in terms of votes, or they start fighting over it, or people change their mind once they see the power of Bitcoin to sort of rip money away from the state. And then, you know, as much as people want to say that's bad for Democrats, it's bad for everybody. Like, you know, both parties in the U.S. spend money that is printed and isn't real, and it does damaging things. It's not just a one-sided issue. So there's a lot to be seen, you know, honestly, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the medium term in the next, say, 5-10 years. That's one of the things that we'll be watching.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things as well, like relating to that. I certainly feel like some of the chapters in your book, I mean, really, they speak to a very practical, almost Austrian economics type perspective around incentives. I mean, again, what are the incentives for the Republican Party or whatever to continue doing what they're doing? I mean, there's clearly a reason to do it, and there's not an incentive to do what is good for the American people. And that, you know, that 101 Austrian economics, you know, it's about the incentives and what people do. Yet there's still this, I think, human first, human centric approach, which for me is just common sense. You know, it's like, what's an economy without people? You know, like you got to have, you know, you're only as free as the people around you. And I mean, that just seems silly to think otherwise, that, you know, you can have a gated community. But anyway, I guess.
No, they think that, but go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, though, but I mean, again, coming at this, you know, my perspective here, you know, I look at the US, it's, as you say, it's a country of 4% of the world's population controlling a currency that represents 80% of global trade. And there's this hegemonic power, political, social, military power. You know, New Zealand doesn't have a military to speak of, really. We follow along, yet culturally, I would say we are relatively distant. So there's this interesting relationship where, you know, generally American warships not welcome in New Zealand because of their nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Generally speaking, our relationship with China or the UK or Europe is, on a day-to-day level, is a lot stronger than our relationship with the United States, though I think our government does take some or quite a lot of direction from what the US is doing. And so we're in this really interesting zone where it's like, well, New Zealand, it's a small nation. And I'm curious what your thoughts are for your book and sort of what Bitcoin means for these smaller, maybe less aligned countries that are not within that US dollar power system.
Right. You know, I think that the argument that I'm trying to make in the book is simply that having one nation in control of the global reserve currency gives that nation really an unfair advantage, that should just sort of ring to like, all right, what is fair and what's unfair? And that should speak to people. Most people in my target audience, of course, are American and have not had to think very critically about how does America come by its wealth and its power and its superiority in a global sense, and its ability to sort of influence geopolitical situations all over the world, or at least entangle themselves in it. They just think that, you know, most people I talk to, all right, well, America's the good guys and we're going to go out there and do whatever we want because we're going to do good things anyway. Of course, nothing can be further from the truth, really, when you start to dig. And so for nations who find themselves in the periphery or are not sort of tied into the US dollar, you know, system, or have their, you know, want to branch out away from that, Bitcoin offers an opportunity to have a totally neutral reserve currency. And I do think that, you know, maybe the Central Bank of New Zealand doesn't adopt Bitcoin until it has to, right? And maybe that's the same is true for Canada and the UK and China, whatever. But like eventually there's going to be a momentum where people are going to have to like buy in or invest or learn or sort of you know, hedge their bets a little bit with Bitcoin. And then once that ball gets rolling, it won't stop. And I just envision a more fair and just world in which one nation doesn't get to pull the levers of that monetary policy for the rest of the world. And so that's my hope for Bitcoin, is that it becomes, if not the global reserve currency, but maybe backs a global reserve currency, or there's some sort of configuration that is more fair and transparent. And one nation doesn't have the advantage over the others because they can print more money and buy oil with it, or they can print more money and buy warships with it. And every other nation has to follow along no matter what it is. So that's generally, you know, just in the most basic sense, my hope. And that would, you know, that affects everybody, right? That affects people in New Zealand and Africa and South America and everywhere else too. So that's sort of the baseline vision that I would have for the future, and at least a hope going forward.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's interesting. I'm just wondering whether you might see some parallels around colonialism and the dollar hegemony, like that extractive nature of it.
Yeah, that was my first talk at the school where I work. I gave a talk about Bitcoin, and it was essentially the Bitcoin's response to the monetary colonialism through or neocolonialism through monetary policy, which is essentially, you know, we've done away, we've made it look nice, right? We've left these countries and now they're free. We're not, you know, we're not colonizing them anymore, but we still control all the levers of their economy and of their financial policies and their monetary policies. And, you know, powerful nations can extract value in terms of labor resources, you know, natural resources away from those nations and make them dependent on the richer nations. This is all a function, not all, but it is in large part a function of the way money works now and the legacy financial system that we're all born into. And Bitcoin offers an opportunity for people who right now are disenfranchised and marginalized and don't have power. And that could be anywhere in the world, but you think, you know, poor nations all around the world, global South, you have an opportunity to break free from that relationship and exert power and control that you never had because you're not reliant on another nation to set your monetary policy for you, or you don't need to agree to, you know, extractive policies where like, okay, we'll give you this loan as long as you export all of the mineral that we want from your nation, we'll give you the loan. All of that kind of goes away, or at least works towards going away in a Bitcoin standard or some sort of role that Bitcoin has in a global sense. That's the hope. And so, yeah, I think that that's ultimately, that's one of the more powerful arguments for people who consider themselves progressive in the United States, is the idea that like, we're not necessarily the good guys. We're out there controlling the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and keeping poor nations poor. It's all for our benefit, but like, that's not fair. And I think people can see that and react emotionally to that. And there's not been a solution until Bitcoin came along, right? At least the potential of a solution. And so I'm trying to get the word out.
Yeah. No, and I think you're doing a really good job of that. And I think it is interesting with this talk about the global south, and it, the kind of the examples, I think Alex Gladstein talks about this a little bit, or quite a lot, you know, the IMF and the World Bank's exploitative practices. But I mean, for me, again, the lived experience of New Zealand, you know, we're going through this internal struggle here around colonialism and decolonization. But actually, the reality is everyone here, no matter what the color of your skin is, was colonized by Great Britain. And you only have to walk down the street and see the lack of infrastructure in New Zealand and the challenges we have historically from our money being pegged to, you know, the British pound. And I think that's something that's not spoken about so much, you know, these... We're not, because we're not quite a poor former colony in the total sense, but we still were colonized. And so there's this interesting relationship where all of the wealth, all of the native timber, all of the mineral resources historically were extracted and ended up in the United Kingdom. And New Zealand was left with cold houses, you know, broken infrastructure, a broken country in many ways. And it, but it's the descendants of that period who are now having to fix it, and it's getting very partisan and very divisive. But I believe, you know, for a smaller country like New Zealand, and that there is, I think, others who don't quite fit into the clear-cut category of neocolonialism, but still we are dealing with the historical impacts of colonialism and monetary policy, which was skewed towards a power structure.
Yeah, and yeah, it's almost a full spectrum, right? Of sort of the United States currently lives on one end of that spectrum, right? And I think that just in the most basic sense of fairness, moving away from that sort of structure where one nation has that control, and you know, every other nation in the world, you don't have to be a poor former colony that doesn't have any infrastructure or any resources at all, right? Like it affects every other nation in the world. And so that's the hope that I have for Bitcoin, is to help move the needle away from that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's I think it's a really great mission. And as you say, it is a spectrum. You know, New Zealand's maybe somewhere in the middle. I don't know. But it's certainly, we're feeling a pinch. And I'm noticing that part of my journey getting into Bitcoin is noticing that and feeling like, you know, we need to do something about it, focusing on solutions, as you said earlier. So coming back to the book, though, A Progressive Case for Bitcoin, you've had a lot of interest. I'm sure it's really blown up for you and you know, made a big change in your life. What's next with the book? Are you doing a tour with the book? Like what's happening with that?
Yeah. So I am, my school gave me a year sabbatical. So, the intention of the sabbatical is to promote the book and to educate people about Bitcoin. So I have quite a few like local-ish events and in-person appearances and book talks, book signings, that kind of thing. I'm going to be a speaker at Bitcoin Amsterdam, and I'll be a speaker at Pacific Bitcoin coming up. Both of those are in October. And just generally speaking, I'm going to be putting myself in the way of opportunity and talking to people like you or anybody else who wants to talk about Bitcoin. There's a lot of people out there who know nothing and are interested to learn. And so I'll be hopefully a resource for those people. And ultimately, it's going to be as whatever I can do to get the word out, not just about the book, but about Bitcoin as a tool to help make the world a better place as much as I can. There has been a lot of chatter around me making young readers edition or a book that's like this, but centered, targeted for teenage audiences, because I have a lot of experience in, teaching high schoolers and teenagers. That might be a longer term project, something I'll definitely, get started during my sabbatical year, but not finish. But yeah, I think that the goal is for me is to do kind of a localish tour and then go where I'm invited to speak about the book and about Bitcoin as a tool for social justice and equity and sort of shaping the world that I think that a lot of progressives would like to see with a new tool that they haven't learned about yet. That's an exciting opportunity for me.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I wish you the best luck with that. So Jason, if people want to get in touch, follow along with your journey, what's the best way for them to do that?
That's great. So I'm on Twitter or X. It's C Jason Mayer is my handle. And I also have a website for the book. So if you go to www.bitcoinprogressive.com, then you can learn about the book. There's links to buy the book. or learn more about what's in it and what are the details about each chapter and things like that. So, and there's also a way to contact me through the website too. So bitcoinprogressive.com, you can be in touch with me, buy the book and learn about the book. It's a great place to start for most people.
Sweet. Well, hey, thank you very much for your work on this and for coming on the show. And yeah, all the best of luck with the rest of your local rollout, international speaking about the book and all of that.
Yeah, thank you, Cody. I appreciate it. I had a good time talking.
Yeah, sweet. All right. Thanks, Jason. Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you'd like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.